Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another woman who has agreed to share her particular path with us. And today, I am very pleased to introduce to you Mahogany B. Mahogany is a name that you may recall as a hip-hop sensation first hitting the scene in the early 1990s. Mahogany B., welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. I appreciate you having me.
Now, Mahogany, before you entered the scene, as it were, you were a little one. And so I'd like to start with where you were born. Tell us that.
Okay, I was born in New York, in the Bronx, to be exact.
Okay. And what was your childhood like in the Bronx?
It was a childhood. I think, you know, all of us at some point in our childhood don't look at it as a very positive experience, depending on, you know, perspective. I had a very normal childhood up until about 10. Things started to get a little different. And so, yeah, my childhood was a little rough.
What happened at around 10?
Well, just a lot of changes, a lot of changes around me. I lost my best friend to murder, and I had to live that experience out, which wasn't the most pleasant, and it changed the course of my life.
I would think so. How does a 10-year-old even conceptualize that a friend is gone and that they've been sort of stolen by murder? How do you deal with that as a 10-year-old? How did you deal with that?
Well, actually, when she officially was gone, I was 12 at that time. And you really don't. You don't understand. I was young and very wet behind the ears, I should say. So I didn't really understand the magnitude of this life that we're living. I know that my mother said, you know, be careful before we left the house. I know that she said, be home when them lights came on in the street. But I always thought she was overreacting up until, you know, the moment that the person that I spent my daily routine with was no longer around.
And, you know, be careful, watch where you're going, be careful around you, come home before the lights go on. I mean, that is such a standard, or at least it was such a standard admonition from parents, you know, kind of the world over. So there was no reason for you to particularly think that she was being anything other than what most kids thought their parents were being, which was, you know, kind of an overreactive pain in the whatever.
Exactly.
Were you with your friend when she was, how did she die?
Okay, you probably know the story of Jessica Guzman, 1990, murdered by a serial killer from Castle Hill. Pretty much we were together like every single day. She was also a martial artist. We trained together, we hung out together, we had a daily routine. After school, we meet up, do homework, and, you know, go bike riding and things like that, up until it's time for karate class. So this particular day, our routine was changed because she had a project to do for school. And within that project, she had to do it with another classmate. And she had to go to this classmate's house. And the classmate just happened to be the niece of the serial killer.
Oh, boy. That's hard. That's really hard.
Yeah, it's heavy.
When, after this happened, you say that it changed the course of your life. How did your life change?
Well, I went from a, you know, pretty gullible child who looked at, you know, life through happy lenses to seeing it for much more and not so positive. So, when you're a child and that reality sets in and you're now forced to live a life with a void you know, the person you was with constantly every day. You didn't see one without the other. And then now I'm alone every single day. It took a huge toll. So I became a little angry, much more wild, a little self-destructive. And I would say that music had a hand in helping therapeutically, because I could have turned out a whole lot worse.
As you think back to that time and the loss of your good friend, is there anything that you could suggest to adults today in terms of how they respond to children who've experienced a significant loss? Anything that was said or not said to you then that you think is particularly useful for adults to think about today?
I think about this all the time. I had a lot of loving people around me who cared a great deal about, you know, how I was feeling and what I was going through, and understood that it was a huge loss for me. However, I was not in a space to accept all that was thrown in my, you know, my direction. So there were people asking how I was doing. There were people who kind of, you know, checked in on me on a regular basis. My mother, you know, did her part as far as, you know, getting me therapy and things like that. But it's very hard to gauge if you're doing the right thing for each individual. Everybody deals with things differently.
True.
I would just say, like, just really pay attention to, you know, someone's habits change. If someone becomes withdrawn and doesn't want to deal with anyone, if they don't talk much, you know, even if you're asking them constantly if they're okay, usually if the signs are saying they're not, then they're not. And you just got to gauge with that person how you can go about, you know, coming to some conclusion.
So really pay attention, which is excellent advice that actually a lot of folks don't, not maybe not a lot, but many folks don't necessarily think about in terms of children. They don't think about children necessarily as having their own separate lives and way in the world and ways that they think about and things and feel. And so don't pay attention in the way that would be useful for both the adult and the child. So I would say that that's a really important piece of advice. Was there anyone in your life growing up in school or out of school who you thought was a particularly positive influence on you?
My influences were usually family members. And honestly, you don't understand how big of an influence until the years pass. You don't understand that you are, you know, paying so close attention to certain people and emulating certain things that they're showing you. My mother was a great, great role model. But while I was young, I don't think I seen it then. I see it now.
What would you say are some of the things that you learned from your mom?
I learned a great deal from my mom. My mom always, what I would say, and I tell people this all the time, is I was blessed with a parent who pretty much put her money where her mouth is. She did not, she said, don't do drugs. She didn't do drugs. She said, don't smoke cigarettes. She didn't smoke cigarettes. She said, don't drink. She didn't drink. She said, you can do anything you want to do as long as you put your mind to it. She showed us that. I'm an artist. She's an artist. And, you know, she walked the walk that she talked. And I like to believe that that is exactly what I do.
She sounds like a wonderfully powerful influence in your life.
Big time.
How did you come to the world of music?
See, as I was saying, excuse me, a little bit earlier, Music actually helped me to get through a lot of the woes of my life. I always was a writer. I deal with many aspects of art. And writing poetry was one of the things that I did often. And being around a mother who collected music, my sister danced with a dance group, and my brother was a DJ, and my other brother, he writes plays and rap music at the time. I'm watching all of these people who I find to be great people in my life, and they introduced me to something that ended up being a very powerful piece. So I went from writing poetry to actually writing raps. My brother used to write rap and ask around the house, like, what should I put next? I can't think of a word, and I would help him. And when he used the words that I'm giving him, it gave me the confidence to say, you know, I could do that. And so that's what I did, and I got serious about it after Jessica died, because then it became, like, therapeutic. I'm writing about my feelings and getting it out, because I refused to get it out by talking to other people. I didn't speak much to anyone about, you know, what I was feeling emotionally, but I definitely did put it in my music.
So music was indeed a tremendous healing force in your life.
Indeed.
As you were writing poetry and writing rap, did you expect to make a career out of it?
By the time I started taking it seriously, yes, definitely. I had deals on the table that came and went. I had at the time, what most would think was a little piece of success when it comes to music, but never got to my idea of success within music, because it ended up changing so much at the end.
What do you mean when you say you had a little piece of success?
Well, I mean, what most would think is success. You know, I created, I was able to create freely. I had investors investing in my craft, so I was constantly in the studio for free. I had producers that were producing for me for free. I was doing shows in big venues, and the crowd was very, very much accepting of me. So a lot of people looked at that and said, you know, she's doing it. But I wanted larger success. I wanted to be, I guess I wanted to be commercially successful. And By the time that actually became an option outside of the industry having control of me, I no longer was in love with music.
It's interesting that you would say without having the industry in control of you, because I know you know probably better than most the advantages and the pitfalls of having a manager, having an agent, having someone to represent you and negotiate for you. It can be flip sides of the same coin, yes?
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
For someone who's just starting out now and wanting to be an independent artist, what do you think they need to think about? What kind of personal skills do they need to have in order to walk that path of independence?
Well, I actually talk about this often. Honestly, it's changed so much now that social media is here, YouTube and things of that nature. Anyone can be a star. And not necessarily have all of the talent as the people who influence us, but the key is media, knowing how to actually utilize social media for marketing, because your following is going to be the key. The support is going to be the key. And I would tell everyone to get a publisher. You need a publisher to make sure that the world knows that you exist and to get you into certain doors so that people are constantly seeing you. We are in a time where people do not, you're not validated unless people feel like you're already doing big things. And so you have to appear as such in order for people to actually check you out and see what you have going on.
Which is really kind of unfortunate.
It is.
But I think that that mindset of the industry may stymie a lot of persons.
Say that one more time.
I would think that the mindset of an industry that says we want you to have made it big before we're interested in making you bigger really gets in the way of moving forward for a lot of folks who are, particularly those who are trying to take the independent path.
I agree. I think a lot of that talent is actually lost within that space. You have artists and then you have hustlers. And so the hustlers are winning right now. The talents are stuck kind of doing their thing just for the love of it and not really reaping the benefit of all that they have to offer.
With social media, is it reasonable to assume that you can actually create a song, create something, put it on YouTube, for example, and that with luck, you could be an overnight sensation? Is that a realistic possibility?
Well, it's actually very realistic. It's happening. But it really takes a great deal of support. You have so many people who have good music. They're talented. They have the quote-unquote look, you know, to be packaged. But they're not the most social. And since they're not social, they don't have a great deal of people that are following them or that they connect with. And because of that, those will not be the people who are overnight success, even though they have the better song and the better look and the better, you know, ideas. So it's kind of a catch-22.
Sounds like it.
You
were going to say...
I was just going to say that what I noticed as an artist myself and someone who tends to, like, keep the company of artists, a lot of actual artists are not the social butterfly type. We kind of like to stay in our own space and our own heads and create. And so that's why I feel like the art is getting lost.
Interesting, because you know the myth for people who are not in that arena is that artists they're all making money, they're all having a great time, they're all going to parties, and they're all happy all the time, and that's not reality.
That's actually the furthest from reality. I mean, I think people tend to mix up what an artist is and what they're seeing out here. And this is not like a shot at anyone. But, you know, you have creators, you have artists who, you know, who are actual artists, and then you have people who are trying to find a niche within an avenue that just looks like, you know, I can make money. As I was saying earlier, the hustler. Hustling may be an art form, but that doesn't make you an artist.
Gotcha. And I think it probably is an art form for some. Mahogany D, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue. I'd like to talk to you about the Straight Talk documentary, what that was all about and what your hopes are for that.
Nice.
All righty. Folks, we'll be right back. So stay where you are. Mahogany, tell us about the Straight Talk documentary.
Wow. So the Straight Talk documentary is like, that was my baby. In 2009, actually, I was training for a fight, and one of my closest acquaintances, like family, we grew up together. We were training together, so we were around each other often, and he had many questions for me. I'm a black lesbian female, and he's a black straight male, which had a lot of questions about, you know, the gay community, and I'm always open to conversing as long as I feel like the conversation, it leaves room for growth and is respectful. And so he would ask me questions constantly, and it just brought the idea of the Straight Talk documentary. So Straight Talk documentary is actually a documentary which I brought the gay community and the straight community together on one platform to speak of the misconceptions that one another have of each other. And it created such a conversation at a time that the conversation was kind of taboo, that it became a great piece. And so I asked everyone who was a part of it, especially the straight community, when they spoke, you know, to be honest, speak your truth, speak as if you're speaking, you know, if you're in a barbershop with the fellas. I don't want anyone to hold their tongue, you know, I'm not going to take offense, I just really want to know your truth. And so that's what happened. And you could just imagine the conversation that came from that.
It sounds like it had all the potential for being healing and powerful all at the same time.
That's exactly what it did. Actually, at one of the red carpet events, some of the red carpet interviews, people were saying, you know, I was homophobic. This kind of has me thinking differently a little bit. And so, you know, that made me extremely happy because, you know, that was the purpose, not to change anyone's mind necessarily, but to get people thinking outside of the box and kind of checking themselves a little bit.
What is your perspective today about the world for black lesbians, for gay people, but then particularly for black folks who are gay? What's the world like for them? Welcoming for you? Welcoming, not so much? Have things changed? Are they the same?
A lot has changed, especially since Straight Talk has came about. When we did Straight Talk, gay marriage was still a no-no everywhere. So a lot has changed. But then again, you know, with change comes other changes. So what I'm seeing is kind of a tug of war. We have a lot of pushback. So where we feel like we've taken great strides in some areas, and you have, because when I was growing up, we didn't have, you know, many gay people on television. Or should I say saying, you know, being openly gay on television.
Right.
You didn't have, you know, commercials that said that it was okay to be this. You didn't have television shows that put us in, you know, a positive light. You didn't have billboards and things like that. We were just hidden and we don't exist. And that is it. And so me growing up, being a lesbian female was like, I can't tell anyone this. I can't be this out. I can't be myself because it's wrong. It's wrong to be who I am. And so a lot of things come from that. And then now you have the opposite. And so, you know, the millennials, you know, feel like, oh, I can, you know, I can go either way. I can do what I want and it's fine. And so it's great within the freedom of that. The freedom to be yourself and to not feel like who you are is a negative, but also with that comes stigmas because while they're trying to figure it out and they're not quite sure who they are, or they don't, it's hard for them to understand who they actually are, because it's like, I knew I was gay from the beginning. They're kind of being marketed and promoted certain things. So they're like, they don't really know what they like or don't like and who they actually are. And because of that, there's a lot going on. And for the people on the outside of that, it looks like the gay community is just a bunch of confused people that we've been saying forever. We've been saying forever that these people are just confused and all messed up. And so now this kind of gives validation to that to some degree. And so I don't really know what to say about the state that we're in, because it is very confusing for me, and I'm in the LGBTQ community. It's a hard one.
Would you say that the Black community specifically has mm-hmm. been able to be open and welcoming to all of the members of the Black community? Or do you think that there are perhaps too many who remain homophobic?
Yeah, the Black community, you know, the rules just seem to be different. We're raised differently around different rules. And so, yes, it is much, I don't want to say much harder, but it is a tough space to be in, being Black and being a part of the LGBTQ community. It's like, I go through this constantly. It's so many different chapters. This is a huge conversation, because you have the male versus the female. You have the feminine versus, you know, the aggressor. You have the Black versus the white. It's so many different, like, pockets that is very hard to deal with. And so I work out, I'm around guys at the gym, and they have a whole lot to say about gay people. I'm not speaking about you, Mahogany. You know, you're different. But them. And so I'm constantly having that conversation. So, yes, the Black community still has a whole lot of fight left in them against this so-called war on LGBTQ. That makes it very uncomfortable for many to be themselves. But I'm hoping that we're getting closer to, you know, a better place.
That would be nice for all. You referenced your fighting. Talk about the fighting sport, particularly as a woman. What have been your experiences?
To be honest, I don't see a huge difference, except, I mean, growing up, being the personality that I am, I've always had a need to prove myself amongst the males in every sector in my life. I've heard plenty say, you know, girls can't rap back in the day when I was doing it. And so I would battle the guys who say that and make sure that I came out the victor. And martial arts is the same thing. And so females just have to earn their respect on a whole different level in every realm, including fighting.
So much fun being female, huh?
I mean, it's a driving force, though. It makes you great.
Talk for a moment about the Hood Symphony. What was that about, and what prompted the creation of that?
Are we speaking of the movie, or are we speaking of the music video?
The music video.
So I lost my father at the very tail end of 2004. My father was a huge person in my life, and I needed to pretty much speak my piece about how I felt about losing him, you know, all of those emotions that came along with it. Like I said, music has always been my therapy. And so one day I just wrote it, and it's one of the, I think it's going to be the most timeless song I've ever created.
I don't know all of what you've created, but I would certainly suggest that the Hood Symphony is in fact a timeless piece.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
At some point, you moved from hip hop into filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Why? You know, I was about to say why the switch, but when I think about music videos, which is filmmaking, maybe it's mm-hmm. not such a great switch after all. I don't know. What do you think?
That's pretty much it. Around the end of that album, the This Is My Story album, which the Hood Symphony is on, I was having a problem. Like, I put out that package, which was a book, an album, and a movie. I did that. That was in 2007. So if you think about it, YouTube just came into existence at the end of 2006 and didn't really catch on until 2008, like, to where everyone started using it. And it wasn't, it's funny because life has changed so much from then till now. In this 10-year span, so much is different. I had no longer, at this point, you know, I had some really bad situations in the music industry, and decided I wanted to be independent. So I did that album independently, and we did not have camera phones, and we did not have YouTube and different things like that. So I was relying on the people that I knew who was like in film school to shoot videos. And you find out very quickly whether you're alone or not when you need people. And so what ended up happening was I had to go and figure out how I was going to cut the middleman out, because people just weren't showing up or allowing me to utilize them as, you know, they utilized me. So I went and bought a cheap MP4 player with a camera on it, and I tested it out, and I did the very first Hood Symphony video with it. And the crazy thing was the quality was horrible, but the video was a really good video. And so when I posted it at the time, MySpace was really big, and I posted it, and I started getting some video shows hitting me back and some radio shows hitting me back and saying, you know, we would really, really love to play this. Like, I want to know some more about you. And I was like, okay, we moving to another chapter now. So I went to a studio one day. I met a guy named Gary Cortell, who I hold responsible really for me, you know, running full speed ahead with creating film, because he's in the film industry and he does like amazing work on a whole nother level. And he seen this video. I showed him the video and I said, you know, I just want an opinion of somebody who, you know, does this. And he looked at it and he said, you know exactly what to do. If you had my equipment, you'd be unstoppable. And so from then on, that's what I've been doing. At the time, like, music changed a lot. Heartfelt music wasn't really on high demand, and that's what I do, heartfelt music. Just real lyrics weren't in demand. Everything just started really changing, a little poppy. And so I lost the love for creating the music and, you know, found the love in creating visuals. And that's how, that came about.
And you have created a visual which is a bit of a science fiction movie.
Yes, yes.
And of course, I think science fiction is amazing. So I'm not biased at all when I ask you to tell us a little bit about The Raging Boom.
I would love to. So this is my new baby. A lot of people ask me, how did you come up with this concept? Everyone that I speak to about this movie asks about how I came up with the concept. And I really cannot take credit for the concept. This is a God-given thing. Sometimes I just wake up with ideas and I run with it. And I really don't know what brought the concept to mind. I just know that it's nothing new under the sun. So this is actually something that happens. You know, when you're sitting back and you're listening to slow jams, it puts you in a different mood than if you put on some very fast-paced, active music. I listen to a specific type of music right before I get in the ring to fight, and it gives me exactly what I need to be in the mindset to fight, as well as, you know, when I just want to be in, you know, a really calm space and like take myself down a notch, I listen to different music for that. So I just took that idea and I put it on steroids, and that's how The Raging Boom came about.
It sounds like music is your medicine. I mean, you've been saying that, but that's really what it sounds like.
Definitely, definitely. It's a part of me. It's a part of all of us. And my research while doing this movie, I recognize how much sound and rhythm is a part of the human makeup. Your heartbeat is rhythm. You know, it's a part of our entire makeup. So that's why we're able to connect to it so deeply. It's a part of us.
It's a part of us, and it's a part that you listen to. Some people don't, but you do.
Yes.
We're going to take a break in a moment, but when we come back, I'd like for you to, if you would, tell us a little bit more about The Raging Boom, the actual concept, and I don't know how much more you want to talk about it, but I think it would be interesting for us to hear from the creator's perspective what it was about and what it's intended to say or bring up for people as they watch it.
Nice.
Okay. Cool. We will go to a break, and when we come back, folks, we will continue with Mahogany B, who will discuss her current baby, her newest feature, and it is a feature-length film, and it is entitled The Raging Boom. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Can you tell us more about The Raging Boom?
Okay, I would love to. So the way I look at it is, for many years, you've had people that actually, you know, committed murders and did a whole lot of criminal activity and blamed it on watching movies, right? And so, of course, you know, some things you see visually and you emulate it. But how about the concept of something that makes you feel something, you know? Music, rhythm, makes you feel things. So how far-fetched is it that something that makes you feel aggressive to make you act aggressive. The way that the movie is made up is like depending, it doesn't work on everyone. But nothing does, right? Nothing works on everyone. No one has the same reaction all the time. So what we did was we made it, it's a song which five college students got together to create for a science project. So they had to do all of this research to find out how humans respond to sound. And while doing this research, they found that different beats and sounds make people respond in different ways. And with that, they took sounds that made people aggressive. It took sounds that made people sexually stimulated. It took all of these different sounds and they put it together hoping to see a response, a different response come out. And what happens is, according to the person's personality, maybe their mood, the rhythms create a reaction. Some people have no reaction at all, so you won't see everyone going crazy. But some people, you know, have more aggressive personality, so it makes them respond that way. And so this is what the movie is about. It's about music having a hand in making people do certain things. And let's be honest, when you listen to music today on the radio, they're playing the same five songs a million times. So it's kind of like it's kind of like brainwash, right? So you're constantly hearing the same song over and over again. And then these lyrics are making people respond in different ways or making people emulate different things. I just took that and I put it merely in a beat. So instead of it being the lyrics, instead of it being something someone said, it's actually a connection between you and rhythm that makes you respond. And I thought it would be pretty hot to be able to, you know, create that visual.
There is a scene which I won't describe in great detail, but there is a scene in the movie with a pregnant woman that is on a lot of levels completely hysterical. But then on another level, it's like, don't do that, lady. Please don't do that. It brings up a lot of reactions as you watch the movie. Tell us about the process of making this. I mean, this was your baby. You conceived of it. You wrote it. You created. So for somebody who's listening and they say, oh, I'm going to make a movie. I'm going to do just what Mahogany is doing. What do they do first?
Ooh, okay. So the process is pretty strenuous, especially when you don't have a team, when it's you. But here and there, I did have people peek in and, you know, give me some assistance. I wrote it. Once I came up with the concept, I'm kind of like, I always have to complete what I start. So as soon as I came up with the concept, it was like the fire underneath me to like, write the script. And so as I'm writing the script, you want to think about how the scene is put together and what the people who are outside of the scene, the people who are watching it, what are they going to take from it? Are they going to get the story that you're trying to put out there? Or, you know, how is it going to come across? So, you know, it's an intense process. And then you're trying to get a team together because you don't want to, and I honestly don't recommend someone wearing all the hats. You know, if that's what you have to do, then I say do it, because I don't think anyone should stop their process because other people are not jumping aboard. That's the reason why I did it all myself. But in a perfect world, I wouldn't have done it all myself. I would have had a team. So I tried to put a team together, and I had some people in the beginning. And then, like, after the first day of shooting, I was alone. And so, you know, the train doesn't stop. You have to keep pushing. So I'm setting up cameras, and I'm checking to make sure that I have all the necessary equipment needed. So you definitely need a checklist to make sure on your daily shoots. What shots are you catching at this location? What characters are needed? What props are needed? What does this scene look like? What are the shots that need to be captured in this scene? You need all of that daily to make sure that you're not forgetting anything and to make sure that you keep everything consistent.
If you had the team, best of all worlds, unlimited funds, what would that team have consisted of? A writer, director, who would have been on that team?
Well, I enjoy the writing and the directing. Those are my hats, and I will continue wearing those hats. But I would definitely need an assistant. I would definitely need, you know, camera people. I would definitely need producers, and talent scouts and location scouts. Like, I did all of that on my own. I would need that so that everything is not on me. I feel like a lot gets lost in transition when you're trying to do everything. There are many things that I feel like I could have done a great deal better with the Raging Boom had I had that assistance. But the fact that I didn't and I came out with this product says a great deal about me as a filmmaker and as my work ethic.
Absolutely. First you come up with the idea, and then do you write the whole story and then go about creating the characters, or how does that, I mean, do you have like two or three different scripts giving you different information, location, props, lighting, direction? How does that all come together?
Well, yeah, it is a process. So my process is probably different than most. I come up with a concept and I think of all the different things that this concept can bring to the table. So if the concept is like the Raging Boom, the human response to music, all right, where does music take place at? Where do you usually find music? And what do people do with music? Like, I'm asking myself all of these different questions. Like the scene that you spoke of earlier with the baby, it's like, that's realistic. I like realistic scenes and realistic ideas. So the fact that the headset is being put on the belly, you know, this is what people do. And we recognize that babies still in the womb can hear everything that's going on, can feel the mom's emotions and different things like that. We know that. And we can either utilize it to, you know, utilize it to teach the baby, read to the baby, talk to the baby, bond. Or we can do little stuff like that to see reactions out of the baby. And that's what happened in that particular scene. So, yeah, I was coming up with different things. It was some scenes that couldn't actually make it to the movie because of my hands were tied with some things. So, like, I had a car scene in it. That I couldn't utilize because we had to scale down due to it being just me. But yeah, I had a lot of different scenarios that I already put on the table. You know, we listen to music in a car. So what happens in this car that can be like a really groundbreaking response to this music? What happens in this situation, in that situation? And so that's what I did to start. I put all of the situations down. And then I created the script around the situations that I already created.
What I think is really important to underscore, particularly for those who are thinking about launching into this arena, is that every single piece of the movie, every single scene is thought out. The entirety of the scene. It's not like you just wake up and say, I'm going to have a scene of people in the park, and then all of a sudden that's what happens. You've got to really think about and create every single piece.
Exactly.
Plan every single piece. So now it's starting to sound like it's not sort of this, you wake up one morning and you're an instant success. This is really sounding like a lot of work.
It is. It is a lot of work. That's why it takes passion to chase it, because it's not an overnight thing. You don't just make a movie and then it's a hit. You don't automatically have people knocking your door down and rushing to go and see your creation. Like I said earlier, we are in a time where people only check for people who have already made it. So if they don't know your name, you're actually reaching out to people to push it. You need marketing. You need a PR person. You need these things to like make it what you want it to be at the end. It's not a piece of cake. It's work, and it's work prior to it, it's work during, and it's work after. Like, the work doesn't stop after the movie is done. Actually, it's a whole nother level of work after.
So I can't create a movie and then just sit down and relax because it's done now? I still have to work?
I wish. I wish.
All right, so yeah, what's the work after the movie? I mean, it's done already. What's the work then?
Well, you didn't make the movie for it not to be seen. You didn't make the movie just to have and watch on your own. You want people to see it. So now it's marketing, it's pushing, it's getting, you know, responses. You want people to know that it exists. You want people to check it out. You want it to create possible other situations, as I told you earlier. This is to create the situation with Netflix for a series. And you also need the connections to do so. So it's a lot of networking. It's a lot of marketing. It's a lot of reaching out and kind of swallowing your pride and you know, letting people know I need your support. It's a lot.
Earlier, you said that there are some artists who really aren't particularly social. They just want to focus on their art. But it sounds like essentially what you're saying is you're just going to have to get over that if you want your art to go someplace.
Exactly. I recognize that in this realm, we have people who view success differently. So it's not for everyone. Everyone doesn't want to be Oprah Winfrey. You know what I mean? And that's okay. And then you have those who do want to be Oprah Winfrey. And if you want to be Oprah Winfrey, you're going to have to socialize. You're going to have to come out your shell, and you're going to have to, you know, network and deal with people, because that is the only way that is going to happen. The relationships are everything in this game. And I am what most call antisocial, but I'm working on it, because I do want to be the next version of Oprah.
Okay. You know, it's good to have a goal and to keep your steps moving towards that goal.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next big project for you? Or is the focus right now the Raging Boom?
Well, right now the focus is the Raging Boom and taking it as far as it can. I want to make sure it peaks for what we're trying to do. However, I am working. I have a lot of work under the belt that haven't been shot. So I'm really trying to get a budget for one major. I had a director who actually ran into me some years back. I was teaching martial arts to a student in the park, and he found my person to be amazing. And he took a liking to me, and he one day decided, after watching me for a few weeks, he wanted to interview me. He wanted to do a documentary on it. And he has since passed on. Although we started the documentary, we weren't able to finish it. But what's happening now is I'm piggybacking his idea and moving forward with it. So I'm working on a docu-movie about my life. It's kind of going to be like a biography, but I can't call it a biography because I'm still too young. But it's going to be like no other. And we're starting the filming on that actually in another couple of weeks. We're going to start the interviewing session So we're going to do massive amounts of interviews. Any part of my life that is coming up in the movie, I don't just want my perspective. I want all of the perspectives of the people who were there, who, you know, who saw it, who actually experienced it as well. Those perspectives, they're going to be interviewed, and a movie is going to be created around it. But those interviews are actually also going to be a part of the movie. So it's like a docu-movie. The actual movie, but you're going to have a documentary feel as part of it. And I'm excited to work on that.
Will you ever do just a martial arts training video? Is that in the future for you?
Well, actually, I've done that just for marketing for my dojo. But no, I actually have a movie called The Come Up that is about my dojo brother's life, who he almost lost his life in a car accident. And he lost his hand in this accident. As a martial artist, you can just imagine how huge that is.
Yes.
And then after healing, I mean, he still has no use of his hand, but he came back and he won a championship immediately after. And it was like, it's the most empowering thing I've ever saw. And so I wrote a movie about his life. It's a urban martial arts flick. That's gonna come to the table. But as far as like just a regular martial arts documentation, I don't think I ever found interest in that.
Well, you know, you've got so much on the table. I'm thinking that you don't ever sleep, ever.
Hardly. I have this video up from years ago, actually, where it's showing everything that I do. And at the end, it says, I sleep when I'm dead. That's pretty much my life in a nutshell.
Well, I have to thank you so much for carving out this hour for us today and for the Mind Talk listener. I really appreciate your taking time to talk with us today.
I really appreciate you having me. This is actually one of the greatest interviews I've done thus far, and I've done many. So I appreciate the line of questioning. I appreciate you allowing the people to get to know me as a person and get to know my creation. Greatly appreciate that.
My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And again, it's available on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast via iTunes, or you can download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. I would love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so send me an email to Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. And you remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.